BJCs, I know the rules, boss. Okay, how did he get your number? Geismar asked. So far in this investigation, who have you given your numbers to? Both of you.
Hugo and Lacey looked at each other and tried to remember. She said, Myers, Junior Mace, the authorities at the prison. Wilton Mace, Roscoe's widow. Al Bennett, the lawyer who ran against McDover 5 years ago. Naylor at the Gaming Commission, and I think that's it.
That's all, Hugo said. Driving in, I asked myself the same question. Sounds like enough to spring a leak, Geismar said.
But none of those people are even remotely involved with Dubose and the corruption, Lacey said.
As far as we know, Hugo said. So, you want to go? Geismar asked.
Of course we're going, Lacey said.
Geismar stood and walked to his narrow window. He said,
This could be the break. Someone on the inside.
We're going, Lacey said.
Okay, but please be careful.
They sat in Lacey's car at the far end of the casino parking lot until almost 11 p.m., waiting for the informant to check in. It was a Monday night, a slow evening at the tables and slots. Hugo, of course, catnapped while Lacey was online with her iPad. At 10:56, he called with directions. They left the casino, drove 2 miles along a dark, narrow, winding road, and stopped at an abandoned metal building. An ancient portable sign informed them that it had once been a bingo hall. One home was visible in the distance. The bright lights of Treasure Key were far away. The night was hot and sticky and thick with mosquitoes. Hugo got out of the car and stretched his legs. At 6'2" and 200 pounds, and still with the All-American's cockiness, he did not scare easily. Lacey was comforted by his presence. She would not have made the trip alone. Hugo redialed the most recent number, but there was no answer. Something moved in the shadows along the side of the building.
Hello?
Hugo called into the darkness. Lacey got out of the car. A voice said,
Take a few steps this way.
A silhouette was partially visible and not moving. The man was wearing a cap, and the red ember of a cigarette moved back and forth from his mouth. Together they inched forward until he said,
That's far enough. You're not going to see my face. Well, I guess you can see ours, right?
Hugo said.
That's far enough. You are Mr. Hatch, right? That's right. Who's the girl?
My name is Lacey Stoltz. We're colleagues.
You didn't tell me you were bringing a woman out here. You didn't ask,
Hugo shot back.
She's my partner, and we're working together.
I don't like this.
Too bad.
A pause as he took a puff and sized them up. He cleared his throat, spat, and said,
I understand you're hot on the trail of Judge McDover.
We work for the Florida Board on Judicial Conduct, Lacey said. We're lawyers, not cops. Our job is to investigate complaints against judges.
That judge needs to be in prison, along with a bunch of others.
His voice was quick and nervous. He blew a lungful of smoke, and the cloud drifted into the thick air.
You said you work in the casino. Hugo said.
A long pause. Then,
That's right. What do you know about the judge?
Lacey said, A complaint has been filed alleging some bad behavior. We're not at liberty to go into details.
Bad behavior, huh?
He said, and offered a nervous laugh. He flicked the cigarette to the ground, where it glowed for a second.
Can you guys arrest people, or are you just, you know, like, sticking your noses into this business?
Hugo said,
No, we don't arrest people.
Another nervous laugh from the shadows.
Then I'm wasting my time. I need to talk to somebody with some clout.
Lacey said, "We have the authority to investigate and remove a judge if necessary."
The judge is not the biggest problem here.
They waited for more but got nothing but silence. They strained to see the silhouette, but it had apparently vanished. The man had eased away. Hugo took a few steps closer and said,
"Are you there?"
No response. "That's far enough," Lacey whispered. "I think he's gone." A few seconds passed in the uneasy stillness, and Hugo said,
"I think you're right."
"I don't like this. Let's get out of here." They quickly opened their doors and got in the car. As she backed away, Lacey swept the side of the building with her headlights. No sign of anyone. She turned onto the road and headed in the direction of the casino.
"Pretty strange," Hugo said. "You could have had that conversation on the phone."
Headlights approached in the distance. "You think I scared him away?" she asked.
"Who knows? If he's legit, then he's thinking about passing on information that could ruin some people. Naturally, he's reluctant. I guess he got cold feet and ran."
Hugo tapped his waist and said,
"This seatbelt has come unlatched again. That's the third time tonight. Why don't you get it fixed?"
Lacey glanced over and was about to say something when Hugo screamed. Blinding lights were in their lane. A pickup truck had crossed the center line. The collision was head-on, bumper to bumper with a force so violent that her Prius went airborne and spun 180 degrees. At 6,000 pounds and twice the weight of the Prius, the truck, a Dodge Ram 2500, got the better end of the collision. It came to rest on the shoulder of the narrow road, its mangled front end almost in a shallow ditch. The airbag in the steering wheel exploded onto Lacey's chest and into her face and knocked her dizzy. The crown of her head struck the ceiling of the Prius as it caved in, cutting a nasty gash across her skull. The airbag on the passenger's side failed to open. With no seat belt and no airbag, Hugo smashed into the windshield, shattering it with his head and shoulders. The glass ripped his face to shreds and opened a long cut on his neck. Glass and metal and wreckage sprayed the scene. The right front tire of the truck was spinning. Its driver slowly got out, removed his black motorcycle helmet and pads, and checked behind him. Another pickup was slowing down. He stretched his legs, rubbed his left knee, and walked with a limp to the front of the smashed Prius for a quick look. He saw the lady, her face covered with blood, her airbag draped before her. And he saw the black man bleeding from his many injuries. He loitered for a moment, then stumbled away and climbed into the second pickup, where he waited and rubbed his leg. He noticed his nose was bleeding. Its driver got behind the wheel, and they drove away, slowly, all lights off. The pickup turned into a field and disappeared. No 911 call was made. The nearest house was half a mile down the road. It was owned by the Beale family, and Iris Beale, the wife and mother, heard the collision, though initially she had no idea what had happened. But she was convinced it was unusual and needed looking into. She woke up her husband, Sam, and forced him to throw on some clothes and check things out. By the time Sam arrived on the scene, another car had stopped. Within minutes, sirens were heard and flashing lights came into view as two cars from the Tapakola Police Department arrived. They were followed by two units from the Tapakola Fire and Rescue. Almost immediately, a medevac helicopter was called from the nearest regional hospital in Panama City. Hugo was extracted by removing what was left of the windshield and easing him through the opening.
He was still alive, but unconscious and with hardly a pulse. Hydraulic jacks were used to rip off the driver's door and remove Lacey, who was trying to speak but uttering only unintelligible grunts. She was placed in an ambulance and sent off to the tribe's clinic near the casino. There, she would wait on the helicopter. She lost consciousness en route to the center, so did not hear the news that Hugo had died. She would make the short flight to the hospital without her colleague. At the scene, the police went about their business of taking photographs, videos, and measurements, and looking for witnesses. Evidently, there were none, nor was there a driver for the pickup truck. The driver's side airbag had been fully deployed. There was no sign of blood or injuries, but a broken bottle of whiskey was found on the passenger's side floorboard. The driver had simply vanished. Even before the truck was towed away, the police knew it had been stolen 6 hours earlier from a shopping center in Foley, Alabama. Lacey's Prius was loaded onto a flatbed tow truck and taken to a holding yard near the tribe's administration complex. Hugo's body was taken to the tribe's medical facility and placed in a frigid room in the basement where an occasional body was held. Across the street, the constable, Lyman Gritt, sat at his desk and stared at a small collection of Hugo's things. Keys on a ring, folded dollar bills, some change, and a wallet. A sergeant sat on the other side of the desk, equally as mum. Neither volunteered to make the phone call. The constable finally opened the wallet and removed one of Hugo's business cards. He went online and found BJC's website and tracked down Michael Geismar.
"He should make the phone call, right?" asked the constable. "After all, he knows Mr. Hatch, and probably knows his family."
"Good idea," said the sergeant.
At 2:20, Michael answered the phone and was met with,
"I'm so sorry to call, but I believe you work with Mr. Hugo Hatch. I'm the constable for the Tapakola tribe, over in Brunswick County."
Michael stumbled to his feet as his wife turned on a light.
"Yes, what's happened?"
"There's been an accident. A bad car wreck, and Mr. Hatch has been killed. Someone needs to notify his family."
"What? Are you serious?" "No, you can't be serious. Who is this?"
"My name is Constable Lyman Gritt, sir, the chief law enforcement officer for the tribe. I assure you I'm serious. The accident happened on our reservation about 2 hours ago. The young lady, Lacey Stoltz, has been taken to the hospital in Panama City."
"I don't believe this."
"I'm sorry, sir. Does he have a family?"
"Does he have a family?" "Yes, Mr. Gritt, he has a family. A pretty young wife and 4 small children. "Yes, a family. This is unreal."
"I'm sorry, sir. Can you notify them?"
"Me? Why me? This can't be happening. How do I know this is not some prank or something?"
"Sir, you can go to our website and check me out. You can call the hospital in Panama City. The lady should be there by now. But I promise you, this terrible news is real, and it won't be long before some news reporter finds out and calls the family."
"Okay, okay. Just let me think for a second."
"Take your time, sir."
"And Lacey is okay?"
"I don't know, sir. She's injured, but she's alive."
"Okay. Sure, I'll drive over now. Give me your phone number just in case."
"Certainly, sir. And if we can help in any way, please call."
"Sure. And thanks. I know this can't be easy."
"No, sir. It is not." "A question, sir. Were they working on our reservation last night?"
"Yes, they were. They certainly were.
May I ask why? I am the constable.
I'm sorry. Maybe later.
Geismar stayed with Verna Hatch and the children until her mother arrived, then fled the house as quickly as possible. He would forever live with the horror, the shock, the agony, the sheer madness of the family hearing the news that Hugo would not be coming home, and then trying to convince each other that it simply could not be true. At times, he was the villain, the hated messenger unduly burdened with the task of convincing them that Hugo was, in fact, dead. He had never experienced such raw emotional devastation, nor would he ever again endure such a nightmare. He caught himself weeping as he left Tallahassee in the pre-dawn hours. He arrived in Panama City just after 6 a.m. Chapter 13. Lacey was stable but still unconscious. The initial diagnosis included a gash to the left side of her head that required 24 stitches, a concussion that was causing swelling of the brain, abrasions on her face, the result of the violent sliding contact with the airbag, and small cuts on her neck, left shoulder, left elbow, hand, and knee. Her head was shaved, and her doctors decided to keep her in an induced coma for at least 24 hours. One of them explained to Geismar that it would be a day or two before they could assess further damage. But he saw nothing, so far, that could be considered life-threatening. Her mother, Ann Stultz, arrived from Clearwater at 8 a.m., along with Ann's sister, Trudy, and her husband, Ronald. They huddled with Michael, who passed along all the information he had, which wasn't much. Once they were settled, Michael left and drove to the reservation. He waited half an hour at the police station until Lyman Grid arrived for work. The constable explained that they were still investigating the accident, but this much was known. The collision obviously happened when the truck crossed the center line and struck the Prius. The truck was stolen and was registered to a man in Alabama. No sign of the driver, but it appeared as though he had been drinking. No one saw him leave the scene, and they had found no trace of him. The passenger side airbag did not deploy, and Mr. Hatch was not wearing a seatbelt. His injuries were substantial. He had an obvious head injury, and he appeared to have bled to death.
"Would you like to see the photographs?"
"Maybe later."
"Would you like to see the vehicles?"
"Yes, I would," Michael replied.
"Okay, we'll do that, and I'll take you to the scene."
There seemed to be quite a few unanswered questions.
"We're still investigating, sir," Grit said. "Perhaps you could shed some light on their activities here last night."
"Perhaps, but not yet. We'll get to that later."
"An investigation will require full cooperation, sir. I need to know everything. What were they doing here?"
"I can't give you those details right now,"
Geismar said, fully aware that he was only adding to the suspicion. At that moment, though, he couldn't afford to trust anyone.
"Look, a man has been killed in a very suspicious car wreck. I need your word that the vehicles will be impounded and preserved until someone can examine them."
"Someone? Who do you have in mind, sir?"
"I'm not sure."
"Need I remind you that this happened on Tapacola land and we do the investigating around here? No one looks over our shoulder."
"Sure, I understand that. I'm just a bit rattled, okay? Give me some time to think this through."
Grit stood and walked to a table in the corner of his office.
"Take a look at this stuff," he said.
In the center of the table, there was a large, stylish lady's handbag, and next to it was a set of keys. 2 feet away was a wallet and keys. Michael stepped closer and stared at them. Grit said,
"When there is a fatality, we normally go through the personal effects and make an inventory. I haven't done that yet. I opened the wallet only to retrieve a business card. That's how I found you. I have not looked inside the purse.
Where are their cell phones? Michael asked.
Grit was already shaking his head.
No cell phones. We checked all of his pockets and searched the car and found none.
That's impossible,
Michael said, stunned.
Someone took their cell phones.
Are you sure they had them?
Of course. Who doesn't carry a cell phone? And their phones would have their most recent calls, including the ones to the guy they were supposed to meet.
And who was this guy?
I don't know. I swear.
Michael was rubbing his eyes. He suddenly gasped and asked,
What about their briefcases?
Grit shook his head again.
No sign of briefcases.
I need to sit down.
Michael fell into a chair at the table and stared in shock at the personal effects.
Would you like some water?
Grit asked.
Please.
The briefcases would have the files, and the files would have everything. A wave of nausea rolled through Michael as he thought of Von Dubose and Claudia McDover sifting through the paperwork. Photos of the four condos, photos of Von himself and Claudia going to and from their meeting, photos of the judge catching her flight to New York, all the detailed travel records, a copy of Greg Myers's complaint, memos from Sadell, everything. Everything. Michael sipped water from a bottle and wiped sweat from his forehead. When he had gathered enough strength to stand, he did so and said,
Look, I'll be back tomorrow to retrieve this stuff and look at the vehicles. Right now I need to get to the office. Please keep everything secure.
That's our job, sir.
And I need to take her keys, if that's okay.
I see no problem.
Michael took the keys, thanked the constable, and walked outside. He called Justin Barrow at BJC and instructed him to go immediately to Lacey's apartment and find the manager. Explain what had happened, and that Lacey's boss had the key and was on the way. Since they did not know the code to her security system, they needed the manager to disarm it. He said,
Watch the apartment until I get there. Make sure no one comes and goes.
Racing back to Tallahassee, Michael tried to convince himself that Lacey and Hugo, in all likelihood, would not have taken their briefcases with them. They would not have needed them, right? They were making a late-night rendezvous with an unknown witness. What good would the files have been? But then he knew they, like every other investigator, indeed every other lawyer, rarely went anywhere on business without the old trusty briefcase. He kicked himself for BJC's rather lax policy on file security. Did they really have a policy? Since all of their cases were handled with utmost confidentiality, it was a matter of practice to keep the files secure. It went with the territory. And he'd never felt the need to remind his staff to guard things. He stopped twice for coffee and to stretch his legs. He battled fatigue by staying on the phone. He called Justin, who was at Lacey's apartment. The manager would not allow him inside until her boss arrived with her key. As he drove and gulped coffee, Geismar talked to two reporters who had called the office. He called Verna and spoke to a sister. Not surprisingly, she had little to say. Verna was in the bedroom with her two oldest children. He wanted to ask if someone could look for Hugo's briefcase and cell phone, but the moment didn't seem right. They had enough to worry about. His secretary put together a conference call with his staff, and he answered as many questions as possible. Understandably, they were too shocked to work. The manager insisted on being present when they entered Lacey's apartment. Michael found the right key to the front door and opened it. And the manager quickly disarmed the security. Frankie, her French bulldog, was yelping for food and water and had made a mess in the kitchen. The manager said,
Okay, I'll feed the damned thing while you guys hurry up.
As he looked for dog food, Michael and Justin went from room to room. Justin found Lacey's briefcase on a chair in her bedroom. Michael carefully opened it and removed a legal pad and two files. They were the official BJC work files, each with the case number. And between the two, they contained all the valuable paperwork. They found her iPhone recharging on a bathroom counter. They thanked the manager, who was wiping the floor and mumbling just loud enough to be heard, and left with the briefcase and the iPhone. Next to his car, Michael said,
"Look, Justin, I can't go back over there. They associate me with the horrible news. You have to ask Verna for his briefcase and cell phone, okay? Tell her it's crucial."
Michael Geismar was the boss, and Justin had little choice. The Hatch home was easy to find because of the crowd. Cars lined both sides of the street, and several men were loitering in the front yard, as if things were too crowded inside. Justin approached reluctantly and nodded to the men. They were polite, but said little. One, a white guy in a shirt and tie, looked vaguely familiar. Justin explained to him that he worked with Hugo at BJC. The guy gave his name as Thomas and said he worked for the Attorney General's office. He and Hugo had studied together in law school and had remained close. Almost in a whisper, Justin explained the nature of his visit. It was imperative to locate and secure Hugo's briefcase. It contained sensitive BJC files and so on, and Thomas understood. And the cell phone issued by the office was missing. Was there a chance he left it at home? Thomas said,
"Not likely,"
and eased into the house. Two women came out of the front door in tears and were comforted by their men. Judging by the number of cars lining the street, Justin knew the house was packed with stunned family and friends. After an eternity, Thomas came through the front door, empty-handed. He and Justin walked to the edge of the street for a little privacy. Thomas said,
"His briefcase is in there. I explained things to Verna, and she allowed me to look through it. It appears to be in order, but she would not let me leave with it. I told her to make sure it was secure. I think she understands."
"I'm not going to ask how she's doing."
"It's awful. She's in the bedroom with the two oldest kids, and she can barely talk. Hugo's mother is laid out on a sofa. Aunts and uncles everywhere. There's a doctor with them. It's just awful."
"No sign of a cell phone?"
"No. He had it with him. He called her last night around 10 to check on things. I asked her if he had a personal cell phone, and she said no. He used the BJC phone for everything."
Justin took a deep breath and said,
"Thanks. I'll see you around."
Driving away, Justin called Michael with the update. Early in the afternoon, Hugo's body was transported by hearse to a funeral home in Tallahassee, where it was prepared for burial, though Verna had not yet been able to finalize the details. Lacey remained in intensive care throughout the day. Her vitals were strong, and her doctors were pleased with her progress. Another scan revealed a slight improvement in the swelling, and if all went well, the doctors planned to ease her out of the coma in 36 to 48 hours. Lyman Gritt wanted to talk to her, but was told to wait. After a restless night in bed, Michael went to the office at dawn Wednesday and waited on Justin. Still sleepwalking through the nightmare, he read about Hugo on the front page of the morning newspaper. There were two photos, one a publicity shot of Hugo when he played for Florida State, and one in a coat and tie taken for the BJC website. Michael read the names of his four children and felt like crying again. The funeral would be Saturday, 3 days away. He could not imagine what a nightmare it would be. He and Justin left at 7 and drove to the reservation. Lyman Gritt had inventoried the contents of Hugo's wallet.
counted the money, and photographed everything. He asked Michael to sign an inventory sheet, then turned it all over to him. Michael also left with Lacey's handbag. They walked down the street to a small salvage yard with a dozen wrecked cars, a locked gate, and chain-link fencing all around. Without touching anything, they examined the two vehicles. The pickup still smelled like whiskey. The Prius was far more damaged, and there was so much blood that neither Michael nor Justin wanted to probe too much. Their friend's blood, and it was still fresh.
"There will probably be litigation," Michael said gravely,
though he had no real knowledge of this.
"So it's imperative to preserve these vehicles just as they are. Is that a problem?"
"Of course not," Grit said. "Plus the insurance companies will be involved, and they'll send out their adjusters."
"We've been through this before, Mr. Geismar."
"And you've searched everywhere for the cell phones."
"As I said, we've looked everywhere and found nothing."
Michael and Justin exchanged glances as if they were skeptical. They asked if they could take photographs, and Grit said he didn't care. When they finished, they followed the constable to the county road where it happened. They looked around, tentatively at first, and were struck by the remoteness of the place. The perfect spot for an unwitnessed accident. They saw the Beale home in the distance, the old bingo shack not far away, and no other buildings. Michael stared at the pavement and said,
"No skid marks."
"Not a one," Grit said.
"She never had time to react. It looks to me like the truck crossed the center line and they hit right about here."
Grit was standing in the center of the eastbound lane.
"Her car was spun around and was facing that way. It did not leave this lane. The truck, which was of course much heavier, bounced over here and almost went into the ditch. Evidently, it veered quickly into her lane before she could do anything."
"Any estimate of the speed at impact?" Michael asked.
"No, but a reconstruction expert could get pretty close."
Michael and Justin took in the scene and noticed the oil stains, the specks of shattered glass, the bits of aluminum and metal. At the edge of the asphalt, almost on the shoulder, they noticed what could only be dried blood. In the grass, there was a piece of cloth, also stained. One of their colleagues had been killed there, and another had been grievously injured. It seemed like such an unfitting place to die. They took some more photos and suddenly wanted to leave. Frog Freeman ran a country store and filling station 2 miles north of Sterling. He lived next door in an old house his grandfather had built. And because he was always around, and because the store was his life, he kept it open until 10 each night. For all the business he drummed up in rural Brunswick County after dark, he could have easily closed at 6, but he had nothing else to do. On Monday night, he had not closed at 10 because of a water leak somewhere in the beer cooler. Frog sold a lot of beer, most of it ice cold. A malfunctioning cooler was not acceptable, and since he handled all repairs himself, he was hard at work wrestling with the cooler when a customer walked in, looking for ice, rubbing alcohol, and 2 cans of beer. An odd combination, thought Frog, as he wiped off his hands and went to the cash register. He had owned the store for over 50 years and was an expert in predicting what his customers were up to based simply on what they bought. He'd seen everything. But ice, rubbing alcohol, and beer was unusual. Frog had been robbed 3 times, twice at gunpoint, and years earlier began fighting back. He had 6 surveillance cameras around the store. 4 visible, so potential thieves might realize the perils of their planned robbery, and 2 hidden, including 1 above the front porch. Frog stepped inside his tiny office behind the cash register and checked the monitor. White pickup truck. Florida license plates. A young man sitting in the passenger seat. Something was wrong with his nose. He was holding a cloth against it, and the cloth appeared to be stained. The driver stepped into view with the bag of ice and a small brown sack with the rubbing alcohol and beer. He crawled behind the wheel, said something to his passenger, then backed away.
"Boy has been in a fight,"
Frog said, and went back to his repairs. Auto fatalities were rare in Brunswick County. The following morning, Frog's coffee group was wild with rumors. Some black guy and a white girl from Tallahassee got lost on the reservation, and a drunk hit 'em head-on. Stolen truck, and the drunk ran off, just walked away. No sign of him yet. The notion of a drunk driver staggering away from the wreck, disappearing into the depths of the reservation and emerging safely beyond its borders, was a rich source of humor, speculation, and disbelief.
"He wouldn't last an hour out there,"
one coffee drinker said.
"Probably still going around in circles,"
said another.
"Don't worry, the Indians will screw it up,"
said a third. Later in the day, as the details accumulated, Frog began tying things together. He knew the sheriff well, and knew the sheriff had trouble with the Tapakola police. Because of their wealth, the tribe had built a police force twice the size of the county's, and with far nicer equipment. Resentment was inevitable. He called Clive Pickett, the sheriff of Brunswick County, and said he might have something of interest. Pickett stopped by after work, and they watched the video. His first words were,
"That's weird."
He said the county had been quiet Monday night.
"Same as virtually every other night."
Said, as usual, the only signs of life had been at the casino. No one had called in about a fight, assault, Peeping Tom, or suspicious characters. Indeed, nothing was stirring until the two vehicles collided.
"That's about 10 miles from here, don't you think?"
the sheriff said.
"As the crow flies. So the time frame fits." "Appears so."
The sheriff scratched his chin, deep in thought.
"So if the boy with the busted nose was driving the stolen truck, how would he manage to get away and catch a ride with a stranger and get here within 15 minutes? "Don't know. You're the sheriff."
"Maybe the stranger ain't a stranger."
"That's what I was thinking."
Frog agreed to copy the video and email it to the sheriff. They agreed to sit on it for a day or so before they informed the Indians. Chapter 14. Late Wednesday afternoon, Michael assembled what was left of his Tallahassee staff. The two investigators in BJC's Fort Lauderdale office were not included. Justin Barrow, with 6 years of experience, was now the senior investigator. He had played bad golf with Hugo a week earlier, knew the basics of the complaint filed by Greg Myers, but was unaware of the vast conspiracy lurking in the background. He had his own cases to worry about. Maddie Reese, who'd been there less than a year, knew nothing of the story of Von DuBose, the corruption at the casino, and Judge Claudia McDover. Michael started at the beginning, with Myers, and told them everything. They absorbed it with a combination of disbelief and fear. Surely their boss was not about to hand over the case to them. He stressed that virtually none of the allegations in the Myers complaint had been proven, and he was quite certain BJC was in no position to prove them. However, he was convinced Lacey and Hugo had ventured into fatal territory. "The accident reeks of suspicion," he said. "They were lured to a remote place by a potential informant.
We don't know if they actually met him, and we won't know until Lacey can talk. On a straight stretch of road, in clear weather and with no other traffic, they were struck head-on by a stolen truck whose driver will likely never be found. The airbag on the passenger's side, along with the seatbelt, were apparently tampered with and didn't work. And their BJC phones have disappeared, presumably taken. We plan to push hard for an investigation, but we're dealing with the Tapakola tribe, not your typical law enforcement agency.
You're saying Hugo was murdered? Maddie asked.
Not yet. I'm only saying the circumstances surrounding his death are extremely suspicious.
What about the FBI? Doesn't it have jurisdiction?
It does, and we may ask for their help at some point, but not now.
Maddie cleared her throat and asked,
So what happens to this case in the meantime?
It's on my desk, Michael said. Not sure what I'm going to do with it, but it's mine for the moment.
If you don't mind my saying so, Justin said, I don't think we're really cut out for this. If this criminal activity is really happening, what the hell are we doing poking around it? This is for guys with guns and badges and all that crap.
Agreed. And I suppose your question is one I'll take to my grave. We thought there might be an element of danger, and our plan was to sort of sniff around the edges and see what we could find. Keep in mind, a formal complaint was filed, and once it was on our desk, we had no choice but to investigate. I guess we should have been more careful. I should have told them not to go to the reservation Monday night.
True, but those two don't scare easily, Maddie said.
There was a long, heavy pause as they thought of their colleagues. Finally, Maddie asked,
When can we see Lacey?
They plan to ease her out of the coma soon. I'll be there in the morning. If all goes well, I'll have the chance to talk to her. Someone has to break the news about Hugo. Maybe in a couple of days you can visit. Remember, the funeral is Saturday, and we'll all be there.
Can't wait, Justin said.
The police in Foley, Alabama, were informed that the stolen Dodge Ram truck they were looking for had come to rest in a salvage yard on Indian land over in Florida. They notified the owner, who notified his insurance company. On Wednesday afternoon, a man appeared at the police station and said he knew something about the theft. He was a private investigator, known to some of the cops, and he was being paid to follow a young housewife because her husband suspected she was seeing someone else. The investigator had been hiding in his car in a shopping center lot when he saw a Honda pickup with Florida tags parked near the Dodge Ram in question. Two men were in the Honda, but they did not get out. They watched passing cars and pedestrians for about 15 minutes and seemed out of place. The passenger eased out and approached the Dodge. At that point, the investigator, because he was bored and really had nothing else to do, pulled out his cell phone and started a video recording. The thief deftly opened the driver's door with a flat blade. It was obvious he had experience. And within seconds, cranked the engine and drove off, followed by his pal in the Honda. The video clearly showed the Honda's Florida license plates. Few auto thefts are so easily solved, and the Foley police kept the video and thanked the concerned citizen. They tracked the license plates to a man in Dufuniak Springs, Florida, in Walton County, about 15 miles from the casino. The man, one Burl Munger, had a long and colorful record as a small-time felon and was currently on parole. Because it was only the theft of a truck and not a more serious crime, and because it would involve reaching into another state, the Foley police put the file in a basket for items to be done soon, but not tomorrow. Greg Myers and his beloved boat were docked in Naples, Florida. He was having a late afternoon drink on the conspirator when he went through his daily routine of scanning the newspapers from Pensacola, Tallahassee, and Jacksonville. Living on a boat gave him a sense of rootlessness, of never being sure where he would be tomorrow. Keeping up with the news from his old haunts tied him to the past. The good days, anyway, and had become important. Besides, he had a lot of enemies back there, and they occasionally got their names in the papers. He was shocked to read about Hugo, killed in an auto accident late at night on the Tapakola Reservation, and his partner, Lacey Stoltz, badly injured. Terrible news, and for more than one reason. Investigations would follow, leads would be chased, fingers eventually pointed. As always, he suspected the worst, that Dubose was behind the accident, which wasn't at all what it seemed. The more he read, the worse he felt. Though he had met with Lacey and Hugo on only three occasions, he liked and admired them. They were smart and unpretentious, didn't make a lot of money, but were dedicated to their work. Because of him, they were on the trail of a crooked judge and her confederates. Because of him, Hugo was now dead. Greg left the boat and walked along the pier. He found a bench overlooking the bay and sat there for a long time, cursing himself for what had happened. A dark little conspiracy had suddenly become far more dangerous. Chapter 15. Geismar was at the hospital by 8 o'clock Thursday morning. He stopped by the waiting room to check on Ann Stoltz, who was alone. Lacey's vitals remained strong. The doctors had cut off the barbiturates the night before, and she was slowly waking up. 30 minutes later, a nurse came for Ann and said her daughter was alert.
"I'll break the news about Hugo," Geismar said. "You go ahead for a few minutes, and I'll be right behind you."
Because she was still in the ICU, Michael had not asked to see her. When he entered the room, he was stunned at the condition of her face. It was bruised, red and purple, with abrasions and small cuts, and swollen to the point of being unrecognizable. Through narrow, puffy slits, he could barely see her pupils. The endotracheal tube was wedged into the corner of her mouth and taped into place. He gently touched her hand and said hello. She nodded and tried to mumble something, but the tube was in the way. Ann Stoltz sat in a chair and wiped her eyes.
"How you doing, Lacey?"
Michael asked, himself on the verge of emotion. Such a beautiful face reduced to such a mess. She nodded slightly. Ann whispered, "I told her nothing." A nurse slipped into the room and stood next to Ann. Michael eased closer and said,
"You guys were hit head on. A terrible crash, Lacey."
He swallowed hard, glanced at Ann, and said,
"Lacey, Hugo didn't make it. Okay? Hugo was killed."
She groaned pitifully and closed the narrow slits. She squeezed his hand. Michael's eyes watered and he pressed on.
"It wasn't your fault, Lacey. You gotta understand it. It wasn't your fault."
She groaned again and moved her head slightly from side to side. A doctor eased to the side of the bed opposite Michael and stared at the patient. He said,
"Lacey, I'm Dr. Hunt. You were unconscious for over 48 hours. Do you hear me?"
She nodded again and took a deep breath. A small tear managed to find its way through the swelling and dropped onto her left cheek. He proceeded with a quick exam of asking short questions, holding up fingers, and having her look at objects across the room. She responded well,
though with some hesitation.
"Does your head hurt?"
he asked. She nodded. "Yes." Dr. Hunt looked at the nurse and ordered a painkiller. He looked at Michael and said,
"You can chat a few more minutes, but nothing about the accident. I understand the police want to talk to her, but that's not going to happen anytime soon. We'll see how she feels in a couple of days."
He backed away from the bed and left the room without another word. Michael looked at Anne and said,
"We need to discuss something confidential. If you don't mind, just take a second."
Anne nodded and slipped out of the room. He said,
"Lacey, did you have your BJC phone with you Monday night?"
She nodded yes.
"It's missing. So is Hugo's. The police searched your car and the accident scene. They've looked everywhere. No cell phones. Don't ask me to explain, because I can't. But if the wrong people hacked into your phone, we have to assume they can find Myers."
Her swollen eyes widened slightly, and she kept nodding, "Go on." He said,
"Our tech guy says it's virtually impossible to hack the phones, but there's the chance. Do you have Myers's number?"
She nodded. "Yes."
"In the file?"
She nodded. "Yes."
"Great. I'll get to work on it."
Another doctor popped in and wanted to poke around. Michael had had enough for one visit. His dreaded mission was accomplished, and evidently he would not be asking any more questions about what happened Monday night. He leaned a bit closer and said,
"Lacey, I need to go. I'll tell Verna that you're okay and thinking about the family."
She was crying again. An hour later, the nurses took her off the ventilator and began pulling tubes. Her vitals were normal. She napped off and on throughout Thursday morning, but by noon was getting bored with so much sleep. Her voice was scratchy and weak, but also getting stronger by the hour. She talked to Anne, Aunt Trudy, and Uncle Ronald, a man she had never been fond of, but now appreciated. ICU space was limited, and with Lacey stabilized and out of danger, the doctors decided that she could be moved to a private room. That move coincided with the arrival of Gunther, Lacey's older brother and only sibling. As usual, Gunther was heard before he was seen. He was in the hallway, arguing with a nurse about the number of visitors the hospital allowed in each room at any given time. The rule was 3. Gunther thought that was ludicrous. And besides, he'd just driven nonstop from Atlanta to see his kid's sister, and if the nurse didn't like it, she could call security. And if she called security, Gunther might have to call his lawyers. The sound of his voice was usually a sign of trouble, but to Lacey, at that moment, it was beautiful. She actually chuckled, and in doing so, ached from her head to her knees. Anne Stultz said, "I guess he's here." Trudy and Ronald snapped to attention as if bracing for something unpleasant. The door swung open without being knocked on, and Gunther rolled in, a nurse in pursuit. He pecked his mother on the forehead, ignored his aunt and uncle, and almost lunged at Lacey.
"Good God, girl, what have they done to you?"
he asked as he kissed her on the forehead. She tried to smile. He glanced over and said,
"Hello, Trudy. Hello, Ronald. Say goodbye, Ronald, because you need to wait in the hall. Nurse Ratchet here is threatening to call security because of some arbitrary and unreasonable rule they have around this podunk place."
Trudy was reaching for her purse as Ronald said,
"We'll be going. Back in a few hours."
They hustled out of the room, obviously quite happy to get away from Gunther. He glared at Nurse Ratchet, held up 2 fingers, and said,
"One visitor, 2 visitor. Me and Mama. Can you not count? Now that we're legal, would you please leave us alone so I can talk to my sister in private?"
Nurse Ratched happily left, too. Anne was shaking her head. Lacey wanted to laugh, but knew it would be too painful. Depending on the year, or even the month, Gunther Stoltz was either one of the top 10 commercial property developers in Atlanta, or one of the 5 real estate swingers most likely headed for bankruptcy. At 41, he'd filed at least 2 already, and seemed destined to live on that tightrope that some developers seem to thrive on. When times were good and money was cheap, he borrowed heavily, built like a maniac, and burned through cash like it would never end. When the market turned against him, he hid from the banks and unloaded assets at fire sale prices. There was no middle ground. No thought of prudent planning or, heaven forbid, the actual saving of some of the money. When he was down, he never stopped betting on a brighter future. And when he was up, he choked on the money and forgot about the bad times. Atlanta would never stop growing, and it was his calling in life to clutter it with even more strip malls, apartments, and office complexes. During this brief invasion, Lacey had already picked up on an important clue. The fact that he'd driven from Atlanta as opposed to using a private jet was a clear sign that his developments were not going well. Almost nose to nose, he said,
"I'm so sorry, Lacey, for not coming sooner. I was in Rome with Melanie and got back as fast as I could. How are you feeling, dear?"
"I felt better," she said with a scratchy voice. There was an excellent chance he hadn't been to Rome in years. Part of his act was to drop names of fancy places. Melanie was wife number 2, a woman Lacey loathed, and fortunately rarely saw.
"She just woke up this morning," Anne said from her chair. "It would have been a waste to come earlier."
"And how are you, Mother?"
he asked without looking at Anne.
"Fine, thanks for asking. Did you have to be so rude to Trudy and Ronald?"
And just like that, family tension filled the air. Uncharacteristically, Gunther took a breath and let it pass. Still staring at his sister, he said,
"I've read the news stories. Just awful. And your friend was killed, Lacey. I can't believe this. What happened?"
Anne chimed in.
"The doctor said she is not to talk about the accident."
Gunther glared at his mother and said,
"Well, I really don't care what the doctor said. I'm here, and if I want to have a chat with my sister, no one will tell me what to talk about."
He returned to Lacey and asked,
"What happened, Lacey? Who was driving the other vehicle?"
Anne said,
"She's not processing everything, Gunther. She's been in a coma since Monday night. Please back off, okay?"
But backing off was not in Gunther's playbook. He said,
"I know a great lawyer, and we're going to sue that bastard for everything he has. It was all his fault, right, Lacey?"
Anne exhaled with as much noise as possible, then stood and walked out of the room. Lacey shook her head slightly and said,
"I don't remember."
Then she closed her eyes and fell asleep. By mid-afternoon, Gunther had laid claim to at least half of Lacey's private room. He had arranged 2 chairs, a cart on wheels, a night table that once held a lamp, and the small fold-out sofa into a configuration that allowed him to set up shop with his laptop, iPad, not one but 2 cell phones, and a stack of paperwork. Nurse Ratched had objected, but she had quickly learned that any comment from her would be met with a blistering and threatening response. Trudy and Ronald popped in a couple of times to check on Lacey, but got the impression they were now trespassers. Finally, Anne threw in the towel. Late in the day, she informed her 2 children that she was headed back to Clearwater for a day or 2, that she would be back as soon as possible, and that if Lacey needed anything, to please call. When Lacey napped, Gunther either stayed off the phone or stepped into the hallway and worked feverishly but quietly on his laptop. When she was awake, he was either